If you would, open to Exodus chapter number 2, verse number 15 is where we're going to start today. But I want to begin with a little bit on the chronology of Egypt and Israel connected to one another. And this is one of my areas of interest. I've enjoyed doing chronology for a very long time. And so you should probably check out my Chronological Companion to the Bible, which is on the website, intotheword2020.com. And on page 11 of the edition that I've got up there right now, I have the sequence of events that leads up to Moses leaving Egypt at this time in Exodus chapter 2, verse 15. The 18th dynasty of Egypt has some chronological disputations revolving around it in the professional areas, and I have tried to take the ones that I think make the best sense when they are compared to what we know about the Israelis and their history in this time period. And so this is what I think we know. Sometime after 1800 BC, the Israelis end up getting enslaved. Now that's after Joseph has died and the dynasty that he was familiar with, the 12th dynasty, is also gone. It disappears within about a dozen years after he passes away. Then you have the foreign regimes come in and take over the Delta, and we end up with the Hyksos, the foreign kings that have their own dynasties in northern Egypt, while the pureblood Egyptians have their dynasties down in the south part of Egypt. Around 1570 BC, Amos, who is a pureblood Egyptian from the south, he drives northward into the Delta region and he pushes out the Hyksos and he establishes the 18th dynasty, which is a pureblood Egyptian dynasty. I think that in 1456, Amos dies, and his son Amenhotep I becomes the pharaoh of Egypt. Well, about 10 years after that is when Moses is rescued out of the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter. So that gives us the sense that Amenhotep I was the pharaoh whose daughter adopted Moses. Then you have Thutmose I, who becomes pharaoh in 26, and then Thutmose II becomes pharaoh in 1513, and then Thutmose II dies in 1499, and his heir, Thutmose III, is just a little bitty baby. I think he's less than 2 years old. And because of that, Hatshepsut becomes the regent of the kingdom. She is acting on behalf of her stepson, because it's not her natural born son, who will be pharaoh one day. Now, this is what we know historically about Hatshepsut. She pretty much just becomes pharaoh. She even is represented in some imagery as wearing that fake little beard, as well as all the regalia, the hat and the special kilt and everything else of a pharaoh. So she acts as pharaoh until her death, which happens in 1458. So it is my thesis that when Moses kills that Egyptian and it's found out and he feels the need to leave, that the Pharaoh, who is angry about him killing a pureblood Egyptian, is in fact Hatshepsut. Because, as I said, she begins her rule in 1499, and he leaves Egypt, according to the chronology that I'm using, in 1496, so just 3 years later. And then, interestingly enough, it is the year after Hatshepsut dies that Moses is commissioned by God to go back to Egypt and bring the people to the Promised Land. So I believe Hatshepsut is the Pharaoh of Exodus 2:15, and then later again when it talks about those who seek your life are dead and you can go back to Egypt, Moses, that's also about her. So Exodus chapter 2, verse 15 says, when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. Now the he here, the masculine pronoun, is a reference to Pharaoh, which is a masculine noun. And typically the pharaohs were male. In this case, though, I actually think the pharaoh is a female, but the pronoun is still reflecting the masculine office. And so I don't think there is a problem there with my belief that it is one of the main female, the rare female pharaohs of Egypt that we're talking about here. Verse number 15 continues with, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. Now, Midian is across the Sinai Peninsula to the east from Egypt. It is on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. And it is thought and believed historically that Egypt really didn't have any control in Midian at this time. They did have control in the Sinai Peninsula, and they did have influence and control up into Canaan itself. And so Midian seems to be one of the few places that Moses would have been able to go to where he could be out of threat of being, as we would say, extradited and brought back to Egypt for execution. And so the way that he would have gotten there is he would just simply leave the delta and follow the king's highway due east. And then instead of traveling northward along the king's highway toward Mesopotamia through Canaan and through Transjordia, he would have just gone across the Gulf of Aqaba area into Midian itself. Then we are told in verse 15 that he sat down by a well. So he comes to a specific spot. There's a well there. And so he just plops down, probably making his choices about where to go to next. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. So we have a religious figure who is in this particular area that has seven girls. Now they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. So he's kind of a foreigner sitting here watching something play out in front of him. He sees these seven daughters. They come to the well. They start getting the big, we'd call them buckets, containers of water out of the well. And they're either using some sort of pulley system or rope system to bring up out of a deep well, or It's possible that it's one of those types of wells that you follow a little winding stairway down to the bottom and from a platform dip the water out, come back up, and dump it into the trough, and then you repeat the process over and over again. Either way, it doesn't matter. The shepherds, male shepherds, they come along with their animals, and they chase the animals and the girls away from the filled water troughs so that their animals could drink. And Moses immediately is incensed by this injustice. And so he gets up, he comes over there. It doesn't say what he did to the guys, but he made them leave the women alone. And then he helped them get their flocks watered. So he has become kind of a hero to these ladies that he's met in this country that he's never been to before. Verse 18, when they came home to their father Reuel. Now, Reuel is probably a title and not just simply a name. Reu has the idea of a friend or possibly a shepherd, and then Ael is God. It's the generic word for God, the mighty one. And so the friend of God or the shepherd of God would be a good title for a priest of Midian. And so they come back and they report to their father. He said, how is it that you've come home so soon today? Apparently, this was a common practice that these shepherds came and stole the hard work water of the women on a regular basis. And so they usually didn't get home by now. Well, Moses made sure they got taken care of properly, and so they're home early, and he wants to know why. Verse 19, they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. Now, they describe him as an Egyptian because that's what he looks like and what he talks like, because he's lived for 40 years as an Egyptian. He has Hebrew in his background, and he most recently had decided he didn't like being an Egyptian when he saw his Israeli physical family, his relatives being mistreated by the purebloods. But he does look and sound exactly like an Egyptian. Verse 20, he said to his daughters, well, where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. So he is shocked. What, you're telling me you did not bring your Savior back here with you for some supper and a place to stay? And so Moses was content to dwell with the man. So he comes for a visit. And then another extension of hospitality is given and accepted, and another after that. And over time, it develops into a relationship where this man, Reuel, the friend of God, the priest of the country of Midian, wants to make Moses part of his family. And so verse 21 represents some passage of time. We don't know how long. It could be months. It could be years. But eventually, verse 21 finishes by saying, he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. Now, Zipporah means birdie. And so she was certainly one of the girls, one of the women that he saved on this particular day. Now, we know that Moses is 40 when he arrives in Midian, so he's probably going to be in his 40s when he gets married. Zipporah is probably several decades younger than him because she is an unmarried daughter of the priest of Midian. Now, those of you that were listening to the last program, you know that I believe that there's some relevance to the Jewish tradition that's recorded in the books of Josephus that Moses married a princess of Ethiopia or Cush or Nubia during his time acting as a part of the Egyptian royal family. So the question might be, what about that first wife of his? Well, I can only give you my guess. My guess is that Moses left Egypt so fast that he effectively left her behind. Abandoned her, if you will. And she probably went home to mom and dad, back to Cush, because he has disappeared from the scene on purpose. He does not want to be tracked down by the Egyptian authorities. And so that marriage ends up technically ending by abandonment. Again, my guess is that she does not forget about it, and that 40 years later, she will get word that her husband, Moshe, is back in Egypt, and that he is acting on behalf of the Israeli people and the God of Israel to get the Israelis out of bondage. And she will choose then to come back, and she will apparently catch up with them in the wilderness. And Moses will end up having two wives at that point. And Miriam, we will discover, will have a fit about this Cushite woman coming back into Moses' life. And God will have to deal with her for what is effectively some racism, seems to be, by striking her with leprosy, which takes all of the color out of your skin. And so I'll talk more about that later. But Moses apparently took into consideration he can't go back to Egypt. He can't very well contact the Cushite kingdom and let them know where he's at to send his wife there, because that would trigger the Egyptians, who have Cush under their control, to track him down. So he effectively has given up on his first marriage, and so he marries Zipporah. Verse 22. Now the family starts coming along. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom. For he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. The name Gershom is built on the Israeli root that means foreign national, non-native. So that's why he gives him his name. He will have another son right before the Exodus starts. There'll be another son that comes onto the scene, and we'll talk about that one when that happens. Verse 23. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. So I believe this is likely to be Hatshepsut that we're talking about here, because she dies in 458 BC, and Thutmose III finally is able to take full control of Egypt. Now, the suggestion has been made that Thutmose III was so angry about his stepmom not allowing him to be pharaoh, that he started obliterating her memory off of all of the official the Egyptian statuary and documents and things like that. But other leaders in Egyptology have now started suggesting that it wasn't Thutmose the Third that started doing that cleansing of history to remove Hatshepsut, but rather a later son of Thutmose the Third who didn't like what his grandmother, his adopted grandmother, you have to understand, had done to dad. And so I find that all kind of interesting historically. All right, so we now have a change in administration. Hatshepsut is gone. Strangely enough, Hatshepsut did have some softening of her administration in certain aspects. And so the Israeli slaves may have benefited while she was in control. And now she's gone. So Thutmose III seems to crack down on the people, which causes them to groan and cry out for deliverance. And so their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. That's the end of verse 23. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Yitzhak, and with Jacob. And you remember what that covenant was. I'm going to bless you and your seed after you, and I'm going to bring you after 400 years out of Egypt back to this promised land that will be given to you and your seed. So God is now ready to finish that part of the story. Verse 25, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. And so this is the other name. This one actually seems, I think, to be his proper name, his birth name, as we would say. It has to do with abundance. So Jethro, or Reuel, has these flocks. We knew about that. And so now he has given Moses responsibility for taking care of all these flocks. And it's probably, well, it's definitely been decades that he's been doing this. And now he has a special place that he likes to take them. So Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, some of your versions, if you're not using the English Standard or New American Standard, will have the backside of the wilderness. In the Middle East and in Hebrew, the front direction is east. The right-hand direction is south, the left-hand direction is north, and the back direction is west. And so that's why our more modern translations has gone with west here. So the Mount Horeb, which just means great mountain, I believe. Oh, no, wait a second. That was for another one. This has to do with a desert mountain. This is described as the mountain of God. Some people have suggested that this mountain already had a special status as being the mountain of God. I don't think that's the case. I think what we see here is, in telling the story, Moses is already letting us know this desert mountain, this mountain out in the middle of nowhere, is what will become the mountain of God's presence with Israel. So it's just getting ahead of the story a few months. So here is Moses taking care of his father-in-law's flocks. He's got them out in the middle of nowhere, trying to eat the scrub that's part of Midian's grazing regions. And this is all east of the Gulf of Aqaba area and east of the Sinai Peninsula. And because of that, I do not agree with Mount Sinai being located in the southern portion of the Sinai Peninsula. That location was solidified as a traditional site thanks to the travels of Helena, the mother of Constantine, but I think it's an incorrect assessment. I believe that Mount Sinai has to be east of the Gulf of Aqaba somewhere, in either Saudi Arabia or in Jordan. And you will find some places that have suggested a mountain in Saudi Arabia. I have my doubts about that particular site. But the only other place has got to be a high mountain up in the area of Jordan. And there are some significant places there that would fit the things that we know, but there's no traditions associated with it. So I find that a little bit frustrating, even though I think that's the better location when you talk about Midia. And so this is where Moses is at. And as we wrap things up today because of time, this is what he sees. Verse number 2, the angel of he who is, or the messenger of he who is, appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. So we're talking about the Shekinah glory of God. It is not a literal burning fire, but rather the supernatural visible presence of the glory of God. And so it's taking over a bush. And Moses sees it. He looked. Behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And so Moses said, I'm going to turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. So he is just curious about this phenomena. And that's when he meets God.